You're listening to highlights from One Planet podcast interview with conservation journalist Ben Goldfarb. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Reporting this book took me all over the U.S. and to other countries, including Brazil, Australia, Costa Rica, the U.K. It was really an incredibly rich experience to see all of these different locations and all of the different ways people interact with roads and with wildlife on roads. You know, one of the most inspiring places I often think about is Tasmania, which has the highest roadkill rates on Earth, in part because there's just so much wildlife there, lots of roads that wind through the bush and don't really have shoulders. Roadkill is just ubiquitous there. What's fascinating about Tasmania is that the mammals are all marsupials, which means the females carry their young in a little maternal pouch. So what happens frequently, tragically, is that a female marsupial will be hit by a car and she'll die, but her babies, her joeys, will actually survive in that pouch. And so hundreds of people all over Tasmania go around checking the pouches of roadkill, looking for living orphaned babies to rescue and raise to adulthood. And I find that such a beautiful idea. Of course, it's very sad, but it's also inspiring. You know, here in the U.S., we're kind of roadkill blind, right? We look away from the dead animals that we see by the side of the highway, maybe because acknowledging them just reminds us of all of the carnage that we're personally causing in some cases. Whereas in Tasmania, people not only don't ignore roadkill, they actually pay homage to those animals by raising those orphaned babies. The creation of roads is this process innate to all beings. We all are inclined to create and follow trails. We just do it at a much vaster and more permanent and destructive scale. I think we need to reconceive how we think about roads. I mean, we think about roads in the U.S. as these symbols of movement, mobility, freedom. There's so much about the romance of the open road and in our popular culture, going back to the mid-20th century when the interstate highway systems were built. Writers like Jack Kerouac were singing the praises of the open highway, and certainly roads play that role. I like driving. The iconic Western American road trip is, you know, like this wonderful experience, but, you know, I think that the purpose of this book is to say, yes, roads are a source of human mobility and freedom, but they're doing precisely the opposite for all other forms of life. They're curtailing animal movement and mobility and freedom by killing them directly in the form of roadkill, but also by creating these impenetrable walls of traffic that prevent animals from moving around the landscape and accessing big swaths of their habitat, right? So that's kind of the mental reconfiguration we have to go through, is to recognize that, hey, roads aren't just forms of mobility and freedom for us. They're preventing that mobility in all other life forms. Brazil is an interesting country because they have lots of biodiversity and they also have lots of roads. They've, you know, one of the planet's largest road networks, and they're building more roads all the time. In the U.S., our major highway system is mostly constructed already, whereas Brazil is kind of doing that work now. But, you know, in some cases, they're doing it in a more thoughtful, progressive, enlightened way than we did in the U.S. and in Western Europe. I was there with a woman named Fernanda Abra, one of the great road ecologists in Brazil, and she took me on this wonderful tour of the country, and we visited the road that I'm about to read about. On my last afternoon in São Paulo, Abra took me to see one of Brazil's most ingenious roads. We drove for hours through cornfields and sugarcane, the land crimping as we escaped the city's gravity. We slowed to pass horseback riders, their faces shadowed by straw hats. This, Abra said, was onde o vento faz a curva, an idiom that meant, roughly, where the wind makes the curve, the edge of the world. At last we came to Carlos Botelho State Park, a ragged parcel of Atlantic forest that had avoided Portuguese axes centuries earlier. Like many of Latin America's protected areas, and many of the United States's, Carlos Botelho is gashed by a highway, SP 139, the road that connects São Paulo to points west. Rather than allowing SP 139 to rend the park entirely in two, however, the state had taken a progressive approach. As we neared the park, a sign warned that SP 139 was closed between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. when animals were most active. Police cars, fire trucks, and ambulances could still drive through after dark, but otherwise the park belonged to ocelots and jaguarundis. There had been some complaining when the closure was announced, but people had acclimated and roadkill had plunged. The nocturnal closure wasn't the park's only masterstroke. One of road ecology's great riddles is how to get drivers to slow down. Motorists habitually ignore posted limits. Instead, we drive at a road's design speed, which is basically how fast the road itself wants you to go. Highways with gentle curves, wide lanes, and long sight lines have high design speeds. How often have you glanced at your speedometer on an open straightaway and been shocked to see the needle pushing 90? Our highways and cars want us to go fast, and we're helpless to resist. The virtue of slowness, the historian Gary Kroll has lamented, seems like an impossible dream. In Brazil, however, the dream of slowness lived on. On entering Carlos Botelho Park, we found that SP-139 was curvaceous and undulating, its bed rising and falling in waves like a gentle roller coaster. Signs warned of rodovia sinuosa. We are prevented from speeding not only by law, but by design. Practically every highway I'd ever driven on, I realized, was built to facilitate swift and seamless automobility. SP-139, by contrast, deliberately transgressed the conventional ideals of engineering, frustrating human users in service to wild animals. I just thought that was such a cool idea of creating roads that are deliberately intended to drive slow, an idea that really counteracts the purpose that roads certainly serve here in the U.S. Infrastructure is kind of boring to people. It's all around us, and so we hardly notice it. That's one of the things that attracted me to this subject in the first place. You know, roads are so ubiquitous. We don't interrogate it. It's kind of the water in which we swim. My intent in the book was to take that invisible infrastructure and make it visible, and also to dramatize it a little bit. If you're a deer trying to cross a highway, that's the most terrifying, stressful, dramatic moment in your life, right? These roadways that we think of as so mundane are crossing paths with these animals who are undertaking the most incredible, challenging, majestic journeys as they migrate from one point of habitat to the next. I've written a lot about that issue in other articles, and that's just such a heartbreaking thing to imagine, you know, these songbirds that are these tiny balls of feathers and the lightest bone, and they're making these unbelievable journeys from one hemisphere to the next, and for them to just die because they smacked into the window of a Starbucks or something is just the most depressing thing in the world. And it's such an easy problem to solve by putting up films that have little patterns on them so that the birds perceive them. The patterns are so light that they have no impact on human perception, but they can save lots of bird lives. That's the case with our buildings and roads. We know there are solutions, that there are things we can do to protect animals. When in the case of buildings, it's retrofitting some of that glass with those fritted patterns. And in the case of roads, it's these wildlife crossings, right? These overpasses and underpasses with fences on either side of them to guide the animals there. I just think about all of the infrastructure out there that's killing animals. I'm working on this fish book now, and you think about dams. What could be more beautiful and sacred than a salmon's migration upstream? And then you throw up this giant concrete wall that just prevents them from completing that journey. And it's the most tragic thing in the world, you know? So everywhere you look, we're kind of frustrating animal journeys with our linear infrastructure. Around 2014, I was living in Seattle working as a journalist, and I was looking for something to write about. And, you know, somebody sent me this advertisement for a beaver workshop. I didn't know what a beaver workshop entailed, but it sounded cool. So I went to this beaver gathering. It was amazing. It was one scientist after another talking about all of beavers' ecological benefits. Of course, you know, these are animals who build dams, and those dams create ponds and wetlands, and those ponds and wetlands are filtering out water pollution, attenuating floods, and mitigating against drought, right? They're these little reservoirs. You know, they're fighting wildfire. They're providing habitat for all kinds of endangered species. They're sequestering carbon, right? Beavers are kind of saving the planet in so many ways, despite our best efforts to kill them. They're saving us in spite of ourselves. That was just a really beautiful story because both humans and beavers are constantly modifying our environment to maximize our own food and shelter. And yet we're doing it in a way that is fundamentally inimical to all other forms of life, right? And, you know, we're stomping out biodiversity everywhere you turn, whereas beavers are building in a way that promotes all other forms of life, right? They're these incredible agents of biodiversity, conservation, and restoration. And so I think that's the thing that unites these two books is that they're both about architects in a sense. One is about the world's most beneficial architect, beavers, and the other's about, you know, in some ways, the world's most detrimental architect, which is us. There's a team of researchers in Portugal who have created a machine learning system that can actually detect and identify roadkill to the species level. So you mount this system on a car and drive around, and the AI is saying, hey, you know, there are three toads here and two birds there. And that's a powerful software because there's so much roadkill that we don't notice as humans, right? Yes, we see the big animals like the deer by the side of the highway, but we don't see all of those reptiles and amphibians and songbirds, you know, the really small creatures. And we know that roads take an enormous toll on them. You know, here in the U.S., as many as 300 million birds are killed by cars every year. It's just horrific to contemplate. but we don't really notice because we're cruising 70 miles an hour, perched in our little glass and metal bubble in the presence of all of this noise. These birds have to be so alert that they're not feeding like they should be. And so that just reveals how subtle some road impacts are. We all see the dead deer or raccoon or squirrel by the side of the highway, but we don't see the black-capped chickadee that lost 10 grams of body fat that might be enough to prevent a bird from completing its migration. Those subtle sublethal effects are something a lot of road ecologists worry about a lot. I sort of oscillate between despair and hope. You know, there are times when I do feel it's hard to find the hope. There are just so many problems and the scale of the solutions doesn't always match the scale of the problems. I think about roads and it's like, okay, great. You know, we're building these wildlife crossings. Well, we've got 4 million miles of road in the U.S. alone and 40 million miles of road around the world. We're not going to build 40 million wildlife crossings, right? So the problem is bigger than the solution in that sense. And, you know, I think that keeps me up at night for sure. Look, I think the thing that gives me hope is just the number of incredibly smart, strategic, passionate people who I get to meet and talk to practically every day. I mean, I sort of conceive of that as my job as a journalist. Yes, it's listening to communities, but it's also finding those solutions. It's finding the people who are working to make our planet a better place. They're not always succeeding, obviously. And, you know, I think that reporting on solutions doesn't mean you're unilaterally chipper and cheerful all the time, because sometimes the solutions fail. But again, the fact that those people are out there, brilliant, dedicated people working to restore beavers or to reconnect the habitats our roads have fragmented, that's kind of what keeps me going. In the cities, certainly we need better transit, more pedestrianism, better bikeability. And in the rural areas, we need those wildlife crossings. You know, we need to create a world where people drive less, but when they do inevitably drive, it's not as ecologically catastrophic as it is now. I do so many talks and walks and beaver viewing educational experiences, often for young people, for school groups. And the kids are always just so excited to see these animals or even just to see the landscapes that those animals create. And it is one of those hopeful stories out there. You know, I mean, we've been talking about all of the doom and gloom, but, you know, beavers are kind of an antidote to that in a lot of ways. Beavers tell us that conservation works, right? That we can approach the precipice of extinction, but then pull back and say, hey, wait a second, you know, we actually do need these animals on the landscape and we're going to protect them and restore them and help their populations increase. And so beavers are proof that what we're doing as conservationists is not futile, right? That there really is reason for hope and optimism, which beavers demonstrate. And, you know, I think that's a really important lesson for young people to hear, is that you're not just entering this world of eco-anxiety and climate change and depression. You know, there are some really hopeful wildlife stories out there, and you can be part of that future.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.